I'm about 300 short of the number of reservations I need in the cathedral. So when I open the phones, I want your caller. Now, if you keep us in budget, I want to return to some long-neglected subjects. The first time I stared at the rugged exterior of the Great Pyramid of Giza, the largest of man's accomplishments in stone, I was filled with awe at the enormity of the monument. Now, just hold a minute. I'm going to check something behind me out of the books I have here. I want to show a picture to those that have never looked. I don't mind you seeing the back of my head on shortwave. I have a picture I want to show you. Here we go. Here's a nice cross section the cameraman over there can put up on that little tripod and take a picture of that. I've got a couple others here that I want to show you. Here they are in a sunset shot. The camera in front of me can take that picture. As they stand on the Giza Plateau in the center of Egypt. Some people work hard trying to figure out programming. I just make it up as I go. I want a good shot from one of these books. No, the Pyramid of Giza, the main one. These are the times it's fun to be listening on shortwave, because you can't figure out what the hell I'm doing. Here's a nice aerial view of the three of them. I don't know if this will zoom in close enough or not. Sitting on the plateau of Giza. The largest being the so-called Pyramid of Khufu, but he didn't build it. Here we are again with another view. I'll be referring to the Sphinx tonight. It's as long as a city block, just short of the length of a football field, 60 feet high. Here's another shot of the three. Still haven't found the one I want. Picture's worth a thousand words. Here they are towering behind the oases in the area. I still haven't found the one I want. What I'm really doing is giving you time to call your friends. Tell them I'm back on the pyramid. Here's a shot that shows the perspective of the three, with the pyramid of Khufu looming over the other two. The small grave pyramids around it, there is no... The Great Pyramid was not a tomb, no body in it, no hieroglyphics, except the forged ones of Colonel Weiss. Here, this is not the picture I was looking for, but it's good enough. You can put on the tripod over there. There's one more place to look. That'll have to do. As I was saying, those monuments are the subject tonight, particularly the last of the seven wonders of the world, the so-called pyramid of Cheops or Khufu, depending upon the Greek or Egyptian name. The first time I stared at the rugged exterior of the Great Pyramid of Giza, the largest of man's accomplishments in stone, I was filled with awe at the enormity of the monument. At the same time, I was appalled at its condition and the state of the immediate environment. Now, you may say, what book are you reading from? This is mine. No, you can't get copies because... going to be redone and republished. The Great Pyramid, man's, it's my copyrighted material. The Great Pyramid, man's monument to man, had been stripped of its original beauty and perfection. Now it was littered, vandalized, trampled, and urinated upon through ages of ignorance and apathy. That ought to tell you it's mine. Most writers don't know how to tell you what's really going on. I had come to Egypt to explore this ancient structure. The visit to Giza convinced me beyond a doubt that our standard textbooks and the accepted legends of the Great Pyramid are all erroneous. However, even as the academicians are wrong in saying this magnificent monument was built as a tomb for a pharaoh, so too are the mystics and occultists wrong in many of their notions. The purpose of the Great Pyramid is very clear to me, and it's amazingly profound. As I clambered over the huge stone blocks ascending the pyramid, I amazed my Arab guide by stopping and staring and looking at things that he didn't think were interesting. Despite the vandalism and the centuries of erosion, the evidence of Masonic perfection was obvious. The tremendous differences between the Great Pyramid and its neighbors on the plateau were obvious. Standing near the original structure and studying the ancient stonework, I recall a story I'd heard. A modern contractor boasted of how modern methods and equipment could make the building of the Great Pyramids, or the Great Pyramid, child's play. I wondered how a builder could possibly be accurate enough in his assessment of modern workmen and machines, and how they would go about placing the more than 2.3 million blocks of stone atop one another. If I didn't have enough books here tonight, I just got two more. In my mind's eye, I tried to visualize an army of hard hats working with cranes and forklifts and trucks, perhaps even a railroad spur, giant helicopters even. I visualized the signal whistle and the pay line, the engineers and the union bosses. No. No way. We don't have a construction firm today that could handle a job. Hell, we have trouble enough building a section of highway without numerous change orders, material delays, and reevaluation of cost estimates, not to mention union restrictions. I felt the limestone blocks and foolishly tried to count them. I stood at the base of each corner and noted that as much as 30 feet of masonry had been peeled off the original corners. It was easy to see why any theory based upon the exterior measurements was controversial. It would require geometry to develop any accuracy. I even climbed to the top. That's against the rules, but a small bribe to an Arab guide and a start in the quiet early morning hours got around the problem. From the top, the view is gorgeous. Spectacular. Later, while exploring inside, I rushed to the huge blocks of granite that blocked the first ascending passage. The entry is forced around these blocks. One of the keys in the experts' argument is whether these 3 or 4 ton granite blocks could have been skidded down the 130 feet of the narrow passage. Orthodox Egyptologists say that's what happened. Get me a camera, Darrell, over on this. Come over here on this diagram of the pyramid. Zoom in on the King's Chamber and then zoom out a little. I'll guide you. Hurry it up. Zoom out. Now go down the Grand Gallery. Zoom out. To the narrow passage. Go on down to the granite plug. Stop right there. Now, when the Arabs entered, they couldn't get into that first ascending passage because it was blocked with this granite plug. 3 or 4 ton granite blocks, 6,000 to 8,000 pound granite blocks, which the Orthodox Egyptologists say, were skidded down that 130 some feet of that passage to block it. Allegedly, after they buried somebody there, and then they skidded this down to keep anybody from getting up there. Engineers, architects, and I contend it's not possible. I noted that less than a 16th of an inch of clearance existed all the way around the block. You want to cut an inch into 16 parts, and they skidded it down that ascending passage? Keep somebody from going looking at a dead body. And the Arabs couldn't get through the granite. It was so tough. They had to dig through the granite that surrounded over that granite thing and into that ascending passage to continue their way upward. And that's the way you get up there now. You go through the dugout section that the Arabs dug through the granite, through the limestone, to get around that granite plug. That happens to be the point in the timeline in the pyramid that marks exactly the date of the Exodus out of Egypt. And the granite plug is there to symbolize they couldn't go up that ascending passage without miracles provided by God to lift them out from the clutches of the dragon star that dominates that downward passage. But that's a later subject. I noted that less than a 16th of an inch of clearance existed all the way around the block. Not enough clearance to slide the blocks into place from above. Although it's not a key issue at this point of the descriptions I'm presenting, there's a great deal of interest in the stories of mystical experiences enhanced by spending a few hours alone in the main chamber. Go back to the picture you have there. get past the granite fog, which is now available by a passage dug through the granite, through the limestone around it, then you must stoop going up the ascending passage. So go on up the ascending passage. And on the timeline, which I'll talk about later, exactly at the resurrection point of the day when Christ came out of the tomb, the passage opens up in that grand gallery where you can stand erect, zoom in on the numbers there. Can you read that? What is it? 286.1 pyramid inches. It opens up. Now, they took all this trouble to bury somebody. The Arabs, go back to the entrance into the side of the pyramid. Zoom out really quite a ways. Go past the granite plug and up the ascending passage, although it was descending. When the Arabs tried to enter the outside of the pyramid, it was covered with limestone. They tore all the, beautiful white limestone blocks. They tore them all away to build the mosque in and around Cairo. But as explorers and engineers and pyramidologists over the years continued to study this massive structure, they were able to dig down in the sand to the base of the pyramid, where some of the limestone blocks that used to cover all four sides of it are still in place, and thus they could project the true angles and shape and size of the pyramid when it had its limestone blocks intact. But when the Arab who broke into it started the work, he assumed it would be somewhere in the middle, and he missed it, even though there was a door so tightly fixed that you couldn't see it on the outside. They only discovered it after they broke inside. He started right in the middle of the pyramid and missed the descending passage because it's offset to the left. We get our word sinister from the Latin word for left. It was offset, missing the mark, to the left. 286.1 pyramid inches. Now, what's a pyramid inch? Exactly, we can measure it now with scientific satellites and instruments, exactly 1/500,000,000th of the distance from the north to the south pole through the axis of the earth. Not north magnetic pole. True north is based upon a star that changes about every 2,000 years, called the North Star. It's now the tail of the Little Dipper, Polaris. The pyramid was built to coordinate with a date in a 26,000-year precession of the equinoxes, when at the fall equinox, go on out to the Dragon Star, zoom out, the Dragon Star, Thuban, in the constellation Draconis, was the North Star. And as you descend down this passage, come back to the passage, stop there, the limestone blocks, their joints are obviously vertical, like the arrow by the word scored lines. But in the descending passage, you come to a point where there are marker lines drawn on the sides and the top of the passage that are not vertical but perpendicular to the floor of the descending passage. Now, we just joined some people at the 10 o'clock hour. I'm in the middle of teaching on the pyramid, and I'm not even going to catch you up. At that point where the arrow is, instead of the lines being the joints of the blocks vertical, there are scored lines put there marking a certain point in the descending passage, and they are perpendicular to the floor line instead of vertical to the ground. You extend those lines out into space at the same date that the Dragon Star shines to the bottom of the descending passage, and it hits Alcyone, going out to the star, Darrell. Up, 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 to Alcyon in the Pleiades. Go back down to the passage. That crosshair marks a date in the precession of the equinoxes that's fixed. Taking one pyramid inch to a year, you then can start a timeline from that point, B.C., you work down the passage 1 inch to a year on the floor, and you come to the ascending passage exactly at the date of the Exodus out of Egypt. You go up that ascending passage 1 pyramid inch to a year, and you come to exactly the date that Jesus rose from the dead when the passage opens up 286.1 pyramid inches. Now, I'm way ahead of the story, and I intend to be ahead of the story just to bait you a little bit. It took a long time, scientists working with this, and the greatest scholar on the pyramid up until Adam Rutherford, N.D. Davidson, went there as an engineer and a scientist and a mathematician to prove there was no prophetic dateline in the pyramid, ended up writing the most convincing proof of it. But now, going up, because I'm talking about the King's Chamber, it comes to the great step in the mid-1800s, up to the great step, and it turns flat. Then the kind of rock changes, that's why the color changes. You go under a dip there, right at the point of the First World War, and skipping over other significant dates, you hit the wall in the back and turn right, exactly 286.1 pyramid inches, and you come to the placement of the open coffin that never had a body in it, that in cubic space is identical to the Ark of the Covenant. And there are only a few buildings ever built that are built on this so-called sacred pyramid inch. The Ark of the Covenant, Solomon's Temple, Stonehenge, and this great pyramid. In this King's Chamber is where I am in this book right now. Though it's not a key issue, there is a great deal of interest in the stories of mystical experiences enhanced by spending a few hours alone in the main chamber. Another bribe, and I was allowed to spend the night inside the King's Chamber in silence. I spent only 2 hours in solitude, but it was enough to convince me that profound experiences indeed take place. But it depends upon one's definition of the mystical, whether they are indeed such. After catching my breath from the climb, it took me some time to come around to appreciate the situation. Alone at last, the huge granite sarcophagus, chipped and brutalized, captured my attention for a moment. Then I rested. I'm in the King's Chamber. For several minutes, my mind toyed with foolishness, and I tested the remarkable acoustics in the chamber. I'd like to record a sax solo there. Finally, I settled down and savored the magnificent silence, and I began to contemplate my presence in this place of grace. Unless a person has had the fortune to be taught history by one of those rare instructors who fears not to deviate from the textbook norm, he will have been taught that the Great Pyramid is merely the biggest of many such structures built by an egomaniacal pharaoh who sought immortality through entombment in these geometrical monuments. Even those few students who specialize in ancient Egyptian history get only a cursory review of the tallest building ever erected by man until the 20th century. Generally speaking, we're taught that the Great Pyramid was the crowning achievement of the dynasties in ancient Egypt, famed for building the massive tombs. We're taught that a ruler whose Greek name is given as Cheops and whose Egyptian name was Khufu had the huge monument built as a home for his mummified remains. This idea is accepted on the basis of very sketchy evidences and the writings of Herodotus, a Greek journalist who has been acclaimed the father of history. We're taught many things in school, and why should we doubt what we're taught by our own institutions? It was my high school history instructor who impressed me tremendously, and I wanted to be a history major in college, and was, for my bachelor's. The dogmatic overview of history I received in high school was so much a part of my thinking. I remember being quite upset when my first college history professor opened his initial lecture with, "We must always remember that history is precisely that, his story, and nothing more." He stressed how historians traditionally tend to color facts to suit their notions. Any king's chronicler, for example, would most likely bend over backward to make his employer look like a pretty good leader of men, whether this was true or not. Warped viewpoints of historic events over the years become generally accepted fact and tend, like a snowball, to continue to influence thinking. If one takes the time and effort to really study the Great Pyramid at Giza, the first conclusion must be that no people whose culture was only one step removed from the Stone Age could have possibly designed and built such a monument. In order to make the Great Pyramid fit the puzzle framework, a number of terribly obscure assumptions were made by the Egyptologists. If you read any of the standard texts on pyramid-building dynasties, you'll note that whenever the Great Pyramid is discussed, the material is usually prefaced with, quote, "Although there are no records, it is assumed that." It's also curious that this most remarkable... Am I boring you? This most remarkable of all man's monuments is usually granted only a few paragraphs, while the other monuments, which no doubt were erected as tombs, are accorded entire chapters. The obvious difference is that while the Great Pyramid is the most fantastic, there's no basis in historic fact for a detailed discussion of its builders and purpose. The others have writings inside, and paraphernalia of the period were found inside. And some records were unearthed that describe the individuals responsible. The erroneous assumption that the Great Pyramid of Giza was a tomb for Cheops and nothing more, plus the assumption that civilizations did not exist prior to Sumer and Egypt, are the two grossest mistakes in all of man's recorded history. The generally accepted notion that mankind has no solid heritage beyond the digs of the ancient Middle East, and that civilizations before, capable of evolving mankind toward perfection, have not flourished, has retarded the overall consciousness that enhances character growth and harmony with the environment and true knowledge of history. The ancient Greeks wrote into the annals of history that the Great Pyramid at Giza was the first wonder of the ancient world. The genius of classical antiquity may have chosen more wisely than they themselves realized. There is no hard fact anywhere established that the Great Pyramid of Cheops was a tomb. All other pyramid-shaped monuments in Egypt were found to be tombs, so the Great Pyramid must be one. It's assumed. At this point, the controversy isn't important, so rather than stress what the Great Pyramid is not, let's review some of the things it is. First of all, there's no comparison between it and the others when it comes to size and precision of workmanship. The Great Pyramid is massive. If you visualize a 40-story building, First Western building downtown, if you visualize a 40-story building rising angularly from a 13.5-acre base, you get a good idea of the size of the structure. It has been estimated that the huge cathedrals of Milan and Florence, plus St. Paul's Basilica in Rome, plus Westminster Abbey, could be set inside the confines of the Great Pyramid's base. Were we to grind the pyramid, all of its stones, into gravel, we could lay a roadbed 18 feet wide and a foot thick all the way from New York City to Salt Lake City. The length of one side of its square base is more than 2.5 football fields. It would cover the Rose Bowl 2.5 times in length. Now, how many times in width? Each of the four triangular sides sloping upward from the base cover an area of 5.5 acres. The exterior above the ground is 22 acres of surface. That's the whole size of Silver Oaks Ranch that you see us ride and run and do everything on. And at one time, this exterior glistened in the sun like a brilliant jewel. White, turtle limestone casing stones, finely polished, reflected light from the sun and the moon as did no other object ever built by man. Indeed, in the days of Abraham, you could see it glistening all the way from Palestine. The core masonry is made up of an estimated 2,300,000 blocks of limestone. The smallest of these blocks weighs nearly 3 tons, 6,000 pounds. These huge pieces of limestone were cut, roughly dressed, and fitted together with a precision unmatched in any other pyramid. Draw an inch right in front of you on a piece of paper. Just estimate it. You'll be close. Now take the pen or pencil you have and divide that inch into 50 parts. Just start making lines, see if you can get 50 lines in there. No way. You need optical instruments, precision laser. Yet these limestone blocks, 5 by 7 at the end, were joined together, and the variation on the surface between the two limestone blocks joined together at the joints, 1/50 of an inch in 35 square feet. That's how closely they joined. The casing stones quarried and transported from somewhere were 100 inches thick and weighed up to 15 tons. 30,000 pounds. Again, these huge casings were fitted with an optician's precision, same variation, 1/50 of an inch. Some of them are still, with erosion, fitted so well that a business card cannot be inserted between the joints, obviously, 1/50 of an inch variation. Another mystery, the cement poured vertical, is so fine and amazingly strong that it boggles the minds of stonemasons today. The polished limestone blocks will fracture before the joints that have been glued together will come apart. Talk about super glue. Though less than 1/50 of an inch separates the blocks. There's such a difference in skill of the workmanship displayed between the Great Pyramid and the Second Pyramid that it's inconceivable that only one generation separated the two structures, as the Egyptologists would tell us. something never mentioned in standard texts. The Great Pyramid is big and well built. It's such a fantastic piece of work that it's caught the fancy of every thoughtful visitor for the past 5,000 years. More words of praise have been written about this monument than there are blocks of stone in its makeup. The vastness of the job is one of the unsolved mysteries still perplexing today's scholars. Most of the other mysteries are avoided by the learned academicians, but they do allow that they have no idea how people living in the culture we assume existed in Egypt at the time could have built such an edifice. For example, that the Egyptians cut the rough blocks of the core masonry with the bronze tools of the day, 1/50th of an inch variation in 35 square feet, is not conceivable. And that they hewed it out of quarries more than 100 blocks a day, 7 days a week, in order to finish the job in 62 years, which was the time of Cheops' reign. Then, of course, if they did it, the stones had to be transported to the building site and put in place. How did they manage to cut and dress the hard rose-colored granite blocks, which are said to weigh more than 85 tons each, transport them more than 200 miles to the site, put them in place, even harder to determine? Cheops or Khufu, according to the best guesses of modern scholars, ruled for only 23 years, not 62. This means his workers or slaves had to design, cut, transport, and fit all the core blocks at a speed of 300 per day, 7 days a week, in order to get everything ready during their boss's reign. The truth is, we don't know who, how, or when the Great Pyramid was built. Even the most dogmatic and pompous of Egyptologists is forced to admit he has no idea how the ancients managed to construct the Great Pyramid. Pyramids in general, and the Great Pyramid in particular, are far more ancient than Egyptologists have allowed. Recently, the Great Pyramid's remarkable orientation, its aligned to true north, not magnetic north, true north, at a time occurring once in 26,000 years, when the North Star of the dominant constellation at that time that it was built to coordinate with would shine down that north face passageway. True north is an accomplishment for a small building. To align this one so perfectly, recently the Great Pyramid's remarkable orientation became a matter of scientific speculation once again. The March 1973 issue of Science magazine pictured the Giza complex on the cover and featured an article by two foreign researchers who stated that the Great Pyramid is twisted slightly to the left or off true north by about 4 minutes of arc. The researchers reasoned that the original structure was perfectly oriented, so the slight misalignment indicates either a shift in the Earth's pole or a movement of the African continent. Now that's pretty heady stuff. Some unknown ancient builders living just a few generations after the Stone Age, coming out of the cave because their wife had a headache, with their stone axes, laid out this huge square-based monument so precisely that modern-day scientists will seriously consider that the continent shifted rather than that the workmen were inaccurate and built it with a twist to the left. Not only did these ancient cavemen with their stone axes mad at their wives with nothing to do, somehow figure out where true north is, which required a knowledge of the earth's rotations around the sun on its axes and in relationship to the vault of the heavens, and the earth wobbling on its axes like a compass that we draw a little circle with, drawing a circle through the galaxies until every 2,000 years an extension out into the heavens of that axis of the earth will point to another galaxy and thus another North Star. Not only did they have the knowledge of that and line it up to true north, they accidentally selected the prime meridian and the Tropic of Capricorn as a location. Pick up a globe map of the earth, use a piece of string to make the meridian, line from North Pole to South Pole, through the spot where the Great Pyramid is. You will notice that you cross the greatest mass of land on the planet's north-south axis. The line going around the globe from west to east, or the pyramid's precise latitude, you'll see passes through more land mass than any other line horizontal. There are many people who believe that the Great Pyramid is therefore situated at the center of the Earth's land mass and exactly quarters that mass. Another happy coincidence to the poor frustrated caveman who had to do something other than kill his wife for her headache. The more you study the pyramid, the more it'll become apparent that whoever built it knew as much or more about this planet than we know today. The pyramid is also distinctly superior in regard to geometric precision. Long before Pythagoras, some pyramid designer knew about the 3-4-5 triangle and the 2 square root of the 5-3 triangle. Long before Archimedes traveled to Egypt and then returned to Syracuse and exclaimed, "Eureka," meaning "I found it," this caveman pyramid designer was aware of the universal geometric relationship between the diameter of a circle and its circumference. Pi, in other words. And the golden mean also, to skip along. Pi was supposed to be discovered in modern times. They designed the pyramid on the exact angle that makes it a pyramidal reproduction of a circle. And its geometric relationships convey the concept of pi. And why was it built? Well, that's one book. I'll read you another one. See what this old boy has to say. Starts out by saying the making of books there seems to be no end. The Great Pyramid of Giza has been for almost 5,000 years or longer incomparable. The Greeks named it the world's first greatest wonder. Let me show you what Rutherford has to say. I thought I had him. I'm going to read the other one. The Great Pyramid reveals the spheroidal shape of the earth. That is, the amount to which the earth deviates from the true sphere, owing to what is commonly known as the flattening at the poles. but which is in reality is equatorial protuberance. The Great Pyramid reveals the knowledge of the precession of the equinoxes, the length of the Earth's axes of rotation, the duration of the Earth's mean tropical solar tropical year, equal to the time the sun appears to make a complete revolution of the elliptic or the ecliptic, taken from one vernal equinox to the next, 365.24 days, 2 days. Let me simplify this. Around the base of the pyramid, which it took modern cameras and ability to fly over to determine, the Great Pyramid is not square at the base, nor on its sides. It's concave. It curves in. Thus, there are three different measurements on the exterior of the pyramid. Each of those three measurements give you the exact time it takes for the Earth to go around the sun in the regular calendar, to return to a place called perihelion when in its elliptical orbit is closest to the sun, which is the anomalistic year, and the third calendar, which is the time it takes to return to a fixed position in relationship to a fixed star, the sidereal calendar, and the three measurements around the base of the pyramid exactly note those three different calendars in the spherical activity around the sun that is the basis of our calendars. They obviously knew all three of those measurement units that represent the three calendars. I'm trying to find a picture of the concavity. I don't think I have it in this book, or a diagram. Here's a little diagram of the pyramid inch from the North Pole to the South Pole through the axis of the Earth. The pyramid inch is 1/500,000,000 of that distance. The ordinary working cubit is about 18 inches from the middle finger to your elbow. The sacred cubit is exactly 25 of these pyramid inches, which represent 1/500,000,000 of the distance from the North Pole to the South Pole through the axis of the Earth. As I said, the Ark of the Covenant, Solomon's Temple, Stonehenge, and the Pyramid, the Great Pyramid, are built on that measuring unit. In spite of the metric system's attempt to take over, if you look the meters around the edge of the globe, the metric system is based on a measurement on the surface of the globe from the North Pole to the equator. Obviously not a precision measurement, because the Earth's not exactly round. And British and Americans have resisted the metric system consistently. There's some connection between Britain and the pyramid. Stonehenge in Britain, you connect the line between the northwest cornerstone of Stonehenge and the southeast cornerstone. Extend that line as a rum line through the Mediterranean. It hits the pyramid dead on the north face. And the British and American inch deviate less than a half a hair's breadth from this so-called sacred pyramid inch. That's the measuring device of the pyramid. And in the pyramid you have, as I started to read, all these various measurements revealing a knowledge no caveman could have. The duration of the Earth's mean solar year, the length of the Earth's sidereal year, based upon the time it takes to return, as I said, to a fixed star, the Earth's anomalistic year, based, as I've said, based on the time it takes to return to perihelion when the Earth is closest to the sun, the length of the Earth's orbit, the mean distance of the Earth from the sun, the volume of the Earth's crust above mean sea level, the proportion of land and sea on the surface of the Earth, the weight of the Earth, the obliquity of the ecliptic. It is the most accurately oriented edifice in the world. Its four faces, its four sides facing due north, south, east, and west. It's built at the center, governing the arc of the quadrant formation of the Nile Delta, putting it right at the center of Egypt and on the border of Upper and Lower Egypt. Built on the geographic center of the land surface of the earth, as the illustration in the other book of stretching strings on its quadrant and its meridian, it stands on the longest land contact meridian and the longest land contact earth circuit bearing on the earth's surface horizontal. These are just a drop in the bucket of the knowledge encased mathematically in the pyramid. And as I said, it's at the center and at the border. Gotta find a diagram of this. At the center and at the border of Egypt. U.S. Geologic Survey mapped. Here's your quadrant of the Nile Delta, meeting exactly at the border between Upper and Lower Egypt. And when Upper and Lower Egypt are combined, as it has been many times throughout history, it's at the center of Egypt, Upper and Lower. Interestingly enough, in Isaiah 19, there is a passage of Scripture that says, I'm going to read the text. It's a last day prophecy about Egypt and the Middle East. Obviously not yet occurring in history. In that day, Isaiah chapter 19, in that day shall there be a highway out of Egypt to Assyria, and the Assyrian shall come into Egypt, and the Egyptian into Assyria, and the Egyptian shall serve with the Assyrians. In that day shall Israel be a third with Egypt, and with Assyria, even a blessing in the midst of the land, whom the Lord of hosts shall bless, saying, Blessed be Egypt, my people, and Assyria, the work of my hands, and Israel, mine inheritance. In addition, having said that, the Scripture says in this same chapter, in verses 19 and 20, I think I'll read them out of my Bible. If I got one here, I got every other book in the world except my Bible. How'd that not get in here? Anybody got a Bible? The King James, run it over here. I can't believe that my guys who bring in the same things every night will not bring my Bible in. Isaiah 19. Am I still boring you? This is just overview introduction. I hope it gives you a pain in the head so you'll understand. You don't park your brain to be a Christian. Isaiah 19, verses 19 and 20. In that day shall there be an altar to the Lord in the midst of the land of Egypt, and a pillar at the border thereof to the Lord. And it shall be for a sign and for a witness unto the Lord of hosts in the land of Egypt. Now a sign and a witness is a kind of altar different than a sacrificial altar. They built altars in Scripture for two reasons: for sacrifice and commitment, and as a witness. They put up a pillar as a witness, an altar as a witness, to testify to something. Now this prophecy is saying, obviously in the last days, when Assyria and Israel and Egypt are a third of united, peaceful nations with a highway connecting all of them together, descriptions of last day events that have not yet occurred. And in that day, shall there be an altar to the Lord in the midst of the land of Egypt, and a pillar at the border thereof to the Lord. And it shall be for a sign. These verses in the Hebrew, which represent numbers, the letters in the Hebrew language represent numbers, as well as letters that form words. Every single Hebrew word in that passage describing this pillar and altar in Egypt at the border thereof and at the center thereof. I'll read it again. In that day there shall be an altar to the Lord in the midst of the land, center of it, in the midst of the land of Egypt, and a pillar at the border thereof. It's only one nation that can have something at the border that's at the same time at the center. The border of upper and lower, and at the center. This passage of Scripture written in Isaiah, Hebrew letters forming all the words of the text, broken down in their numerical value, comes to 5,449, the exact number of inches from the base of the pyramid to the top. Call it chance, all you want. It's more than chance. Here's your Bible back. When we have music, they'll bring me mine, I hope. At the same time, go back to that picture of the Sphinx and the pyramid. I raced with 70 league boots with one goal in mind, not to have you remember all that I just said. I'm going to be covering all of it as I continue to teach on it. To arouse a curiosity. Try to get somebody to hold that. Reach over there at Daryl and hold that book down. I won't use your camera till it's flat, till they can see this picture in perspective with the Sphinx. Somebody else. He's got too much camera. Somebody run over here and help. Quick. Daryl, get out of the way. You're too slow. Hold that book down. Flat. Until the picture. Now back off to when you see the picture. There you go. That's the Sphinx in relationship to these pyramids. The Sphinx is equally a monstrous monument that defies what the Egyptologists and the historians have been saying for years. I'm going to read you something. Now you can belittle Edgar Casey all you want. Just because the average person walking down the street doesn't know anything about Nostradamus or Edgar Casey, that just reveals how ignorant they are. On October 29th, this is from the Daily Mail, May 2nd, 1996, British newspaper. On October 29, 1935, in the parlor of a small house in Virginia Beach, a small seaside town on America's East Coast, Edgar Casey took off his rimless spectacles, reclined on a couch, and fell into a trance. A tall, stoop-shouldered man with penetrating gray-blue eyes, he appeared to be in a deep sleep. But he was still able to answer questions from his followers. As usual, Gladys Davis, his personal secretary, noted down every word he said. Casey, who was almost illiterate, had become known as the sleeping prophet. He was blessed, or cursed, with remarkable powers that brought him tens of thousands of disciples from all over the world. He frequently predicted the future, pinpointing the dates and locations of earthquakes and other natural disasters. He also diagnosed and healed the sick with astonishing success, though he had no medical knowledge. More eerily, sometimes he, quote, remembered things about the lost continent of Atlantis and ancient Egypt. That afternoon he returned to these memories. The few survivors of Atlantis, he said, had come to Egypt in 10,500 B.C. and had built the Great Pyramid and the Sphinx within 100 years of their arrival, 8,000 years earlier than previously thought by Egyptologists. In chambers around these monuments, they put the historical records and all the wisdom of their lost civilization with the intention that one day they would be found. Speaking in a low monotone, sometimes fluently, sometimes in a halting, ungrammatical fashion, Casey warned his followers that the rediscovery and opening of this record chamber would come before the end of the 20th century and would be closely followed by another cataclysm every bit as deadly as the one that had destroyed Atlantis. The terrible geological forces that would be unleashed would begin to build up gradually after 1958, but the disaster would not occur until the Hall of Records had been opened. It would happen, he prophesied, in 1998, when Christ's light would be given again in the clouds. This is Casey talking, not Gene Scott. I don't set dates. The earth will be broken up in the western portion of America. The greater portion of Japan must go into the sea. The upper portion of Europe will be changed as in the twinkling of an eye. Land will appear off the east coast of America, he said. There will be upheavals in the Arctic and the Antarctic that will make for the eruption of volcanoes in the torrid areas, and there will then be a shifting of the poles. Now, whether his date's right or not, the events he describes are events described in the book of Revelation, not with descriptions like shifting of the poles. But great geographic and geologic upheavals and volcanic eruptions. What he described was a pole flip, in which the earth would capsize as its magnetic poles switched positions. Where is the Hall of Records? He was asked. Because this strange man appearing to be sleeping would respond to questions. Where is the Hall of Records? He was asked. Was it in the Great Pyramid? The sealed room of records, he said, is in a different place, not in the pyramid. He said, in position it lies as the sun rises from the waters, the line of shadow or light falls between the paws of the Sphinx. It may not be entered from the connecting chambers from the Sphinx's right paw until the time has been fulfilled, when the changes must be active. Then the sun will be darkened, and the earth shall be broken up in divers places, and then shall be proclaimed that his Christ star has appeared. Then know ye that Armageddon is at hand. Since his death in 1947, I warn you,
no, sir.
Since his death in 1947, Casey's strange work has been continued by his sons and grandsons and by a multimillion-dollar, 40,000-member worldwide organization, the Association for Research and Enlightenment, that he founded in 1931, as well as offering a repository for the typescripts of more than 14,000 of Casey's trance readings. The association coordinates and decimates his teachings, researches matters that relate to his pronouncements, and occasionally dabbles in a little archaeology. From the early 70s, this has included searches for the Hall of Records conducted by reputable academic bodies, including the Stanford Research Institute of California, using seismic equipment, ground-penetrating radar, drills, and borescope cameras. The association has funded education at the American University in Cairo, of the brilliant young Egyptologist Mark Lehner, who is visiting professor at the prestigious Oriental Institute of the University of Chicago. During the 80s, he photographed and photographically measured and mapped the Sphinx and made several attempts to probe the bedrock beneath it. He also carried a controversial carbon dating of samples of mortar from the Great Pyramid. In the early 90s, supporters of the association contributed to the funding of a geological survey which produced compelling evidence presented in a 1993 NBC and BBC documentary seen by almost 40 million people that the Sphinx could be vastly older than Egyptologists believe, not just 45,000 years old, as is generally thought, but possibly as much as 12,500 years old. If so, it would, as Casey had said, have to be the work of a previously unidentified high civilization of remote antiquity, perhaps even his, and I might say Plato's, fabled Atlantis. The documentary also mentioned the discovery of what appeared to be a chamber under the Sphinx paw, perhaps the site of the Hall of Records. Come over here, Daryl, over my right shoulder, please. Here is a little diagram in this very poor copy of the Sphinx underneath its paw, the chamber, too geometrical to be just a cavity in the rock. Under the bedrock of the Sphinx. Go away, Daryl. Please. Go away. Come to me. Director was asleep on that one. The documentary also mentioned the discovery of what appeared to be a chamber under the Sphinx's paw, perhaps the site of the Hall of Records. This is a fairly large feature. It's about 9 meters by 12 meters in dimension and buried less than 5 meters below the ground. Its regular rectangular shape is inconsistent with natural occurring cavities, so there's a suggestion that this could be man-made. Sophisticated archaeological equipment picked up numerous other indications of anomalies and cavities in the bedrock between the paws and along the sides of the Sphinx. It all looked very much in line with Casey's prophecies. However, before any further research could be done, the Egyptian authorities intervened and expelled the team from the Sphinx enclosure. I have found out that their work is carried out by installing endoscopes in the Sphinx's body and shooting films for all phases of the work in a propaganda but not in a scientific manner, said Dr. Zahi Hawass, director of antiquities for the Giza monuments. I therefore suspended the work of this unscientific mission and made a report which was presented to the permanent commission who rejected the mission's work and future. As might be expected after such an outburst, nothing further happened for some time. Nevertheless, when we talked in February 1995 to Joseph J. Hoda, one of the wealthy members of the Association for Research and Enlightenment, we found him confident that the work of the Sphinx would be resumed shortly. The next 3 years are going to be super years. We sort of have 1996 set up for our little expedition to the Sphinx with underground radar. And I figure that by 1998 we'll hit something, he said. At the beginning of April 1996, bang on schedule, Egypt's Supreme Council of Antiquities granted a one-year renewable license to a team of U.S. researchers to carry out surveys at Giza and around the Sphinx using seismographs and ground-penetrating radar. The team is financed by the Shore Foundation of New York and sponsored academically by Florida State University. Its work is to be the subject of a documentary by Boris Said, the executive producer of the 1993 TV program. In addition, they say, we're surveying the underground of the Giza Plateau. On April 14th this year, Dr. Hawass gave a rather different account than his previous position, where he had thrown them out and left out of this article, complained that they were trying to destroy Egypt's national heritage by suggesting that someone other than Egyptians from some place like Atlantis or some prehistoric other society had built these great monuments in Egypt. But on April 14, Dr. Hawass got in on the act of propaganda, I guess, gives an account mentioning hidden tunnels around the pyramids and the Sphinx. He made no mention of the question of public safety that was a so-called reason for letting them come back in, but hinted that excavation of the tunnels would reveal many clues regarding the establishment of the Giza pyramids. In a short video in which Dr. Hawass recently took part, produced and written by Boris Said, and according to him, financed to the tune of $100,000 by Joseph Schur, Dr. Hawass is shown scrambling into the tunnel. Who's the guy that opened Al Capone's vault? Who?
Ronaldo.
What?
Ronaldo Rivera.
One at a time.
Geraldo Rivera.
Geraldo something. Dr. Hawass is shown scrambling into a tunnel under the Sphinx. When he reaches the bottom, he turns to face the camera and whispers to the viewer, "Even Indiana Jones would never dream to be here. Can you believe it? We're now inside the Sphinx in this tunnel. This tunnel's never been opened before. No one really knows what's inside this tunnel. We're going to open it for the first time." The narrator of the video drives home an interesting point. Quote, "Edgar Cayce, America's famous sleeping prophet, predicted that a chamber would be discovered beneath the Sphinx, a chamber containing the recorded history of human civilization. For the first time ever, we'll show you what lies beneath this great statue, a chamber which will be open tonight, live for our television cameras." The 1996 annual conference of the association, to be held in Virginia Beach in July, next week in fact, is entitled Atlantis-Egypt, Opening the Hall of Records, and on Sunday, July 14th, it will feature the presentation, Searching for the Hall of Records, Current Excavations at Giza. In Islamic Egypt, where 18 Christian tourists were murdered earlier this month in a machine gun attack at Giza, some of Cayce's ideas increasingly have the look of political hot potatoes. He linked the rediscovery of the Hall of Records not only to a global catastrophe, but also to the second coming of Christ. There has also been understandable sensitivity among nationalistic modern Egyptians over the way the Cayce readings trace back the origins of their civilization to the supposed Atlantis events of 10,500 BC. Indeed, in 1994, Dr. Hawass publicly accused the members of the earlier geological project at the Sphinx of trying to spread doubt on the makers of the Egyptian civilization and trying to steal the Sphinx from its true owners, that is, the Egyptians. Come back, Daryl. In addition, scholars in the last few years, using a robot with a camera, explored a heretofore 200-foot-long, 8-inch-square shaft that leads from the Queen's Chamber. And this little robot explored that small shaft, too small for a man to go up, photographing it to the end, where a brass door suddenly is encountered. March 1993 was when this small door made of marble or limestone with two copper handles fixed on it was discovered by a mechanized robot. Upuat II, or the opener of the way, as the word means, in ancient Egyptians. The discovery was at the end of a long, narrow shaft, 8 by 8 inches and 200 feet long. Since then, the discoverer, robotics engineer Rudolf Gantenbrink from Munich, has been banned from resuming the exploration and opening the door. The official reason given by the Egyptian antiquities authorities, known as the Supreme Council of Antiquities, was that Gantenbrink leaked the news of the discovery to the British press in April 1993, and thus apparently broke a rule of archaeology. The director of the German Archaeological Institute in Cairo, Dr. Rainer Stadelmann, sided with the Egyptians and condemned Gantenbrink for his press action. Dr. Stadelmann was adamant about the non-importance of the find. Quote, "This is not a door, there's nothing behind it." The president of the Supreme Council for Antiquities, Dr. Bakker, went as far as claiming a hoax. "The orifice of the shaft is too small for the robot to go through," and accused the German scientists of not having the correct approvals from the SCA to carry out the exploration. Dr. Bakker fired the chief inspector of the Giza Pyramid Plateau, although the official reason given was that a valuable ancient statue had been stolen. 3 months later, Dr. Bakker himself was fired. Amid accusations of malpractice and fraud, Dr. Bakker spoke of a mafia which had been involved with the pyramids for the last 20 years. Refusing to give names, Dr. Bakker said, "I wanted the whole matter investigated by the prosecution authorities, but my requests were refused." Meanwhile, Dr. Hawass, changing position, went to the USA, claimed that the discovery of the door was the discovery in Egypt. In 1994, Dr. Hawass was reinstalled at the Giza Pyramids. Meanwhile, Gantenbrink offered his robot to the Egyptians and also offered to train an Egyptian technician to man the equipment and open the door. The Egyptians rejected the offer. "We're very busy at the moment." 3 months later, Dr. Hawass would declare, "I do not think this is a door and there's nothing behind it." In March 1996, however, Dr. Hawass changed his mind once again and declared Gantenbrink's find as being one of huge interest and that the door would be opened in September 1996 by a Canadian mission, but not including Rudolf Gantenbrink or his robot. The Canadian mission is owned by Amtex Corporation of Canada, a multimedia CD-ROM company who are reported to be raising a huge sum of $10 million to promote a staged live opening of the door on television networks. "I'm working with a private guy who's a personal friend of Hawass, quote, and we're absolutely going to drum this thing to death. Whatever the event we are going to stage, it will be televised live," reported Amtex Corporation's president, Mr. Peter Zuring. In other words, there's a lot going on at the pyramid, which is why I'd like to return to teaching about it again. And with this introduction, I've either turned you off completely or piqued your interest. You get on the telephone and tell me which. In 1989... let me read before that. In the late 1970s, John Anthony West, an independent American researcher, was studying the obscure and difficult writings of the brilliant French mathematician and symbolist R.A. Schwaller de Lubitz. Schwaller is best known for his works on the Luxor Temple, upriver on the Nile. But in his more general text, Sacred Science, first published in 1961, he commented on the archaeological implications of certain climatic conditions and floods that last afflicted Egypt more than 12,000 years ago. Now, if you're already worrying about the note in some Bibles that has the creation in 4004 B.C., that's a crock. That's not Bible. That's an add-on of Bishop Usher, a medieval monk, who dated the events of the Old Testament based on genealogy tables. When the genealogy tables treated cousins and grandsons, as well as sons, all his sons, there's no way you can date anything from the genealogy tables. There's gaps in them. You don't know son from grandson or great-grandson sometimes. That's a medieval monk's idea when they still thought the earth was flat and that the sun went around the earth. Nothing to do with the Bible. He commented on the archaeological implications of certain climatic conditions and floods that last afflicted Egypt more than 12,000 years ago. I'm reading from The Riddle of the Sphinx by Graham Hancock and Robert Vival. Quoting, "A great civilization must have preceded the vast movements of water that passed over Egypt, which leads us to assume that the Sphinx already existed. Sculptured in the rock of the West Cliff at Giza, that Sphinx, whose leonine body, except for the head, shows indisputable signs of aquatic erosion." Now, when Napoleon invaded Egypt, the Sphinx was covered with sand up to its neck. And there are records in the history of the pharaohs and the ancient kingdoms of attempts to restore the Sphinx. An anomaly of the Sphinx is that the head is too small to match the body. There's been a great effort on the part of some Egyptologists to say that it's the head of Khafre, a later pharaoh after Khufu. The truth is, nobody knows what the head looks like. And the head's been carved on again and again and again. What the original head looked like, nobody knows. And with the precision of everything else, there's little doubt but what the original head matched the body. Probably a lion head. And they always tried to date it to about 2500 B.C., Khafre's reign, saying that this little head was a sculpted head of Khafre. But Schwaller made this comment, "A great civilization must have preceded the vast movements of water that passed over Egypt, which leads us to assume that the Sphinx already existed. Sculptured in the rock of the West Cliff at Giza, that Sphinx, whose leonine body, except for the head, shows indisputable signs of aquatic water erosion." Schwaller's simple observation, which nobody appeared to have taken any notice of before, obviously challenged the Egyptological consensus attributing the Sphinx to Khafre and to the epoch of 2500 B.C. What John A. West immediately realized on reading this passage was that through geology, Schwaller had offered a way virtually to prove the existence of another and perhaps greater civilization antedating dynastic Egypt and all other known civilization by many millennia. If the single fact of the water erosion of the Sphinx could be confirmed, it would in itself overthrow all accepted chronologies of the history of civilization. It would force a drastic reevaluation of the assumptions of progress, the assumption upon which the whole of modern education is based. It'd be difficult to find a single simple question with graver implications. The conflict between the Bible and science is science assumes everything's always progressed at the same rate. And they project back and deduce forward. The Bible says man was once better than he now is, fell through cataclysms and started over again. West was right about the implications. If the weathering patterns on the Sphinx can be proved to have been caused by water and not by wind or sand, as Egyptologists maintain, then there is indeed a very serious problem with established chronologies. In order to understand why, we need only remind ourselves that Egypt's climate has not always been as bone dry as it is today, and that the erosion patterns to which West and Schwaller are drawing our attention are unique to the architectural unit defined as the context of the Sphinx. All of them built in the same epoch. But when was that epoch? West's initial opinion was that, quote, there can be no objection in principle to the water erosion of the Sphinx, since it is agreed that in the past, Egypt suffered radical climatic changes and periodic inundations by the sea, and in the not-so-remote past by tremendous Nile floods. The latter are thought to correspond to the melting of the ice from the last ice age. Current thinking puts this date at around 15,000 B.C. But periodic great Nile floods are believed to have taken place subsequent to this date. The last of these floods, great Nile floods, is dated around 10,000 B.C. It follows, therefore, that if the Great Sphinx has been eroded by water rather than sand and wind, it must have been constructed prior to the flood or floods responsible for the erosion. The problem is that the Sphinx is deeply weathered up to its neck. This necessitates 60-foot floods at minimum over the whole of the Nile Valley. It was difficult to imagine floods of this magnitude. Worse, if the theory was correct, the inner limestone core blocks of the so-called mortuary temple at the end of the causeway leading from the Sphinx had also been weathered by water, and this meant floods reaching to the base of the pyramids another 100 feet or so of floodwaters. I saw the special on TV, overwhelmingly convincing to a geologist, and I have an undergraduate major in geology, that the erosion of the Sphinx, 60 feet up to its shoulders, is not the kind of erosion that wind and sand causes, but it's water erosion. Rainfall or flood. Now, as I start teaching again on the pyramid, if I don't have to stop for a marathon every week, we're going to try to move quickly through the foundation that you've been listening to on reruns and get up to the point about where we left off on the pyramid teaching before. Plus, there's been a lot of new research as I've piqued your interest with tonight, and happenings going on right now that make it very relevant in order to follow the news as the current explorations begin to leak out to the press. If you want me to continue on this subject, I want you to say so in the final few minutes, 7 minutes that we have in this half hour. Otherwise, I'll just put all these books back. I want Darrell to come over here and show you something. We'll eventually go in the displays down at the cathedral. Come around behind me, Darrell. But I became the recipient of Adam Rutherford's library, given to me. The four books by Adam Rutherford, if you get a camera down here so I can watch it on the screen. Many of you have seen Pyramidology. He's the greatest student of the pyramids since N.D. Davidson. N.D. Davidson went to the Pyramid of Giza intending, this is his tome, get a camera on it. No, the other one. I want Daryl's camera. Come on. Why he's back. What are you doing, Daryl? Right here. The Great Pyramid is Divine Message. This book will scare you to read in its detail. He went to the pyramid to disprove that there was a prophetic timeline, ended up writing the most convincing study ever put in print. The benefit I have is that all of Rutherford's handwritten notes correcting some of the things with further research are included in this book of Davidson's. Rutherford's notes, Adam Rutherford's signature. I have Colonel Weiss's original two-volume set. Again, he was the fraud who fraudulently inscribed in order to justify the expense of his trip, the so-called cartouche of Khufu in the Davison chambers above the King's Chamber. I have his original irreplaceable books. Go across these two trunks. Adam Rutherford had assembled all the greatest books and all the work that had been done to his day on the pyramid. I've continued to gather what has followed. I'd like to get back on the pyramid. I don't want to have to start again and stop because we've got to have marathons. Now, if you want me to teach on this subject again, you get on the telephone and start expressing yourself right now.